Welcome to episode 221 of Sports Geek. On this week's episode, I chat with Jay Riola from the Orlando Magic about stadiums, fan experience, and data.
Welcome to Sports Geek, the podcast built for sports digital and sports business professionals. And now, here's your host who is designing his next pair of Sports Geek shoes, Sean Callanan.
Thanks, DJ Joel. Yes, my name is Sean Callanan. You are listening to Sports Geek, and I am excited about ordering and designing a new pair of Sports Geek shoes. There is a Twitter handle, at Sports Geek Shoes, because the color, they will be in the colors of my newly named and the new color scheme of our new OPL team, to be announced soon. If you go to newoplteam.com.au, you'll find out and follow the journey of our new esports venture. My name is Sean Callan, and as I said, you can contact me, as always, via social media, at Sean Callan on most platforms, or at Sports Geek as well. Or you can contact me the old-fashioned way, Sean at sportsgeekhq.com. Before I jump into the episode with Jay Riola from the Orlando Magic, just want to quickly update you on the digital dollars process and the workshops and follow-up that I've been doing with a few clubs following the AFL workshop we did recently, and sort of going in on the important pieces of the puzzle and where it works. For those of you who are listening for the first time, the digital dollars process has five pillars. Know your audience, know your content, know your distribution, know your value, and know your pitch. And so the first three work for any business to get your digital strategy and content plans sorted. Understanding your audience, understanding the content you're producing, and understanding the distribution, what channels you're using to get the content out there. The piece that really works from a sports point of view is the know your value. And it starts understanding what would our rate card look like and how can we explain our rate card and why we're charging so much for a particular type of post, a particular type of content, and then how do you build all that together, Lego blocks style, into a pitch. And so it's really important to understand, one, why you're valuing your content and your posts and your channels a specific way, but then more importantly, how you can explain that to your sponsor from a point of view of, this is what we brand, this is what we value our brand and our IP, as well as our really tight relationship you have with your fans. So if you're interested in that, if you're having trouble valuing your content, talking to your sponsors, explaining to them why you're charging certain amounts for what you're doing, please get in touch. You can either go to digitaltodollars.com or email me, Sean at sportsgeekhq.com. I love working with podcast listeners, and so you are amongst them. So please reach out. Really enjoyed my chat with Jay Riola, longtime friend, fellow seat attendee. I always attend his panels on data, ticketing, and CRM, no matter how many buzzwords are in the title of the panel, mainly because he explains it well. But more importantly, he's in the trenches. He's doing it every day at the Orlando Magic. So I hope you enjoy this chat with Jay Riola from the Orlando Magic. Very happy to be joined by the Senior Vice President of Strategy from the Orlando Magic, Jay Riola. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So to get started, how did you get your start in the world of sports business?
Yeah, I think I am a great case study in how many people get their foot in the door in sports. I actually interned four different times before it stuck. Some of them were while I was in school at undergrad, but then I also did an internship post-grad as well. So I went to school at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas, a small Division III school, played basketball, got the idea of wanting to work in sports business because, like many people in sports, was just really passionate, was an athlete, saw it as a unique business, and applied online to an internship with Kroenke Sports Enterprises in Denver, where I grew up and was originally from. and was just really fortunate. Got hired into that internship. It was in youth and fan development, and did two things. One, reinforced that I did want to be in the sports industry, but also helped guide me to an area that I felt like was a better fit based on my interests and skill. So youth and fan development was more around grassroots marketing and youth camps and things of that nature, which obviously are challenging in their own sense. But as being someone who's a lot more quantitative and analytical, it kind of guided me in a different path. The next summer, I interned in with the Spurs Sports Entertainment. So stayed in San Antonio, got to work with the Spurs, did some work on game nights in their media relations department, interned in their game presentation department, which really was supporting their WNBA team at the time, the Silver Stars. And kind of same story there. Got a glimpse into the industry, into the operations, but wasn't exactly what I wanted to do. The next summer after I graduated from school, did a quick kind of like 2 month stint with USA Basketball, where I was more in basketball operations, just doing, it was with their under 18 men's team. And I lived in the dorms with them during their tryout period and then worked games with them. And then ultimately got hired by the Orlando Magic as an intern in their department at the time that was called Business Development and Strategy. And was this, so this was in 2006. I full-time got hired in 2007. 2006, I got hired as an intern. And the department was responsible for the team's new, at the time, new arena efforts. So we were playing in what was at that time called the TD Waterhouse Center, but was the original arena that the team began playing in 1989. And they were the team, the Magic, we were trying to navigate how to get a new arena. And it was obviously like big data and analytics at that time hadn't really quite taken off in sports. So this was a role that was a little bit more quantitative, obviously very strategic, and I felt like was a great opportunity. So took the internship and worked really for a year as like almost our team was running almost a political campaign, because we were working with the city and the county to put forth a plan for three community venues. The arena was one of them. It was also a new performing arts center for theater and music, and then renovations to Citrus Bowl football stadium, which is now called Camping World Stadium. But so worked on that campaign in essence that ultimately got approved in the summer of 2007. And that's when I, you know, finally was able to clear that hurdle and become an analyst, a full-time permanent position.
So that's, so one, I'm still waiting for someone to say, I started off in a mascot costume. You would have got pretty close. You would have got pretty close in you know, working on game night and different things. There's a bit of do everything in that first part of your early part of your career, isn't it?
Yeah. I never put the mascot costume on. I'm too tall, awkwardly tall for that. But I certainly did in my time in San Antonio help with that area of the business. And I think looking back on it, what I was really provided and I'm grateful for now was a pretty comprehensive view into the organization, even at the intern level, getting to see grassroots and youth, getting to see game entertainment and media relations, you know, here getting to see basically a team work with in a public-private partnership to get a new arena approved and all of the inner workings that go into that process. I was really fortunate because all of those offered a crash course in sports business. And I think a lot of times, you know, with those of us in the industry know how valuable interns are to us and how valuable they can be to someone in terms of their career growth if they're in a good organization and with good people. And I was fortunate to have those experiences.
Yeah. And it's really important not to go in with a real narrow focus, because you don't know where, you know, you don't really understand going in to begin with the really wide scope of the different parts of the sports business there are and where your skill set best finds. You found yourself in the data, business development venues, you know, like you said, politicking, but that strategy piece, and that's where you found both your sweet spot from a skill set point of view, but also where
you know, that's where your passion and what you want to do in a career lie. So that's where you ended up. But getting that good breadth early on gives you a bit of a wider scope than coming in and saying, I'm going to be a, and insert, you know, really narrow position.
Exactly.
It really limits what you can do.
It does. Yeah.
So
I think the other thing that I've gained a perspective on now is just there are so many different ways to work in the sports industry that aren't just working for a team. And my eyes were open to that really during the new arena process, where you got to work with architects and contractors and design consultants and technology vendors that we as a team were looking at. And all of these people were professionals in different spaces that worked in sports, but didn't work for a professional team or a collegiate team. And to me, it just, you know, I tell people in school or people looking to get into the industry that you can be very, like you said, you can be almost too narrow at time where you're saying, I only want to work in this space topically, and I only want to work in this like professional sports league or yep. team, then your options are way too narrow. So I agree with you.
So going into that space of business development and strategy and started looking at, you know, buzz terms of big data and how do we tackle our data. And, you know, in that 2007 to 2010 period, there was lots of change and lots of the industry was starting to really dive into that space. And then you're in this, you know, arena project early on, working with, you know, architects that are looking at building out, you know, a future-proof the venue and what's it going to look like 5 or 10 years on. How do you straddle over the last 10 years when you've been in these strategy type roles, having a foot in both camps of what can I provide now that provides the business solutions now, but also have a foot or a vision looking at 5, 10 years down the track. I've got to make sure what I'm putting in place now is going to be, is it, you know, has that future proof to it and be looking at the longer region. How do you balance that in your role, in that strategy role?
It's a great question. And it's a constant challenge. I think we, as an organization, this was really driven by ownership and executive leadership. So Alex Martins, our CEO, and Charlie Freeman, our president, they wanted to hang our hat on technology and knew that being a technologically advanced venue was going to be really important, not only when we opened in 2010, but investing in infrastructure to provide flexibility to kind of grow and adapt into the future. And, you know, what I would tell you, I don't remember the exact numbers here, but like at the time we opened, we were working with some of our tech consultants, and I think we were in the NBA, had like the beefiest Wi-Fi system of any team. And since we opened in 2010, we've probably invested twice to kind of boost our Wi-Fi in the building. And, you know, perhaps maybe even need to do more of that as we push more and more people onto digital tickets and to use the app to enhance their experience. So one, I think just the recognition that technology was a space that needed to be invested in, and it's not a one-time thing, it's a continual thing, but at least if you can do all that's possible to future-proof and provide the infrastructure and the foundation that can be built upon, that was really important. Then the other piece kind of on the tech front that I would tell you was, you're absolutely right. Between 2007 and 2010, so much changed in the ticketing space. That was really when StubHub and secondary ticket markets emerged. And they had been around before, but they really began to emerge. And teams were recognizing the importance of accurately pricing their tickets and dynamically pricing their tickets and being smart about their distribution. And a lot of that, I think, opened up our eyes and our team's eyes to the importance of data and the importance of analytics, you know, and analytical thinking and having tools and people that can make sense of that data. So we, and this is a little bit of just good fortune at the time, obviously we're investing in a lot because we're moving into a new arena.
Yep.
Part of that investment was not just technology in the building like scoreboards and video boards, but was investing in an enterprise data warehouse. We began licensing SaaS analytics software. So we made some of those investments as well. But the other piece that I would tell you, kind of almost like pushing technology to the side for just a second, and I think this is a constant, and you're seeing this across a lot of sports across the world, but definitely here in the U.S., are renovations to buildings and renovations to different premium seating areas, to concession areas, to continue to refine what the in-venue experience looks like, because it definitely has changed in the last 10, 20 years from coming to a game, going to your seat and sitting there watching the game to coming to the game and having like a fully experiential experience where you're expecting to be entertained in different ways, not just in your seat. So I think that is an area that we're constantly looking at. We're studying other buildings and other teams and other sports and trying to make sure that our building has flexibility and adaptability to be able to meet some of those changes easily, you know, without maybe a major renovation, but also just kind of constantly keeping an eye on if we ever were to do one, like what would we be inclined to do that would help generate more revenue, improve the fan experience, kind of keep us as one of the best buildings in our minds in the NBA. So I think it is, like you said, it's a constant challenge to be able to say like, what's the here and now requirement? And also what are we doing for 5 and 10 years down the road?
Yeah, because, I mean, you can go back and it's probably 7 or 8 years ago now, you know, Mark Cuban saying he didn't want fans pulling their phone out of their pockets because he wanted the experience of the game to be so engaging that they didn't need to or didn't want to. And now that whole experience has changed and pulling the phone out of the pocket is part of it, but then it's also now part of it, whether it's the ticketing piece, the payments piece, the fact that they're, you know, it's integrated in what they're doing from an entertainment point of view. And so that's how the venues have had to evolve, because the shopping malls that we're going to, or the theatre districts we're going to that are being developed, or the downtown areas that are being redeveloped, you know, this experiential piece. And that's where you're saying, you know, that renovation piece is becoming so important from a venue point of view. It's the expectation of what fans are now, they want as part of an experience. I don't just want the, I'm going to sit down, have my popcorn and watch a ball game. It's that and more.
Yeah. And consumer expectation is set in industry, not just in sports. Yeah. So when I order my Starbucks coffee from my phone or Chick-fil-A, the expectation of customers is that the same experience is going to be available to them when they come to a sporting venue, and that technology is just part of their experience now. And I think it's our responsibility as teams and entertainment properties to accommodate that as best we can, because it's like I just think that it's a part of the way people are becoming more and more accustomed to operating. You know, like when I travel, I hate having a printed boarding pass. I despise it. I want it to be on my phone. I don't want to have to carry it around and worry about it. I feel a lot more confident. And I think that 5 years ago was not the way the world worked. So that, like, that is pushing people to digital tickets, even though we've been moving that direction for a long time. When the rest of the world operates in a certain way, I think it pulls us that direction even stronger.
So we briefly touched on it. I want to go back to it. The CRM and the business intelligence piece, especially around the ticketing, and especially when you're moving into a new venue, because you have that, you know, that oh my god moment of, oh, we've got to fill this thing. It's great, we've got this great new shiny building, but now we've actually got to put the cheeks in the seats, right? And and for you and been lucky enough to see you speak a couple of times at SEAT, the business intelligence piece. And having, you know, making data actionable, I think was one of the titles of the panels you're on, or I think 2014, it was operationalizing retention analytics using CRM. Love it when we smash all the words into a title of a panel. But the thing is, you actually deliver on the title, which is rare when you go to conferences to get all those together. So how, you know, those pieces of getting into dynamic ticketing and the pricing around it and coming up with a different product mix. How deep did you get into that data piece early on? And, you know, everyone sort of talks about that data journey. How did you get started into that? And like, what were some of the key wins that sort of had the light bulb moments internally to say, hey, this is working, that with, you know, follow the data, the dollars will come, yeah, type of thing. What was that early journey look like? What did that early journey look like?
Yeah. A lot of the credit for the vision of being an early adopter and then ultimately selling that vision and executing on it goes to Anthony Perez, who is now CEO of Venue Next, was our chief marketing officer, and is someone who, you know, I had the opportunity and good fortune to work for almost 10 years here with the Magic. And he was, after I worked on the Arena project until 2010, I transitioned to be on his team. And his team was really, it was like three of us at the time whose task was to basically build an analytical unit within the organization that would, using data analytics and quantitative thinking, add value to the business performance of the organization. So, you know, when we moved into Amway Center, as I touched on, like, there was recognition that data, consumer data and business data, was of incredible value. And at the time, we didn't really, one, in our old venue at TD Waterhouse Center, which was later named Amway Arena. But at that venue, like, I still remember when I worked for the Magic in those early years, we had to send people to two ATM machines to withdraw cash to then spend it at our retail and concessions. You know, all of our tickets were printed. We had no Wi-Fi. So there's almost no venue data that was coming back to us that we could do anything with. And when we went into Amway Center, we moved to like the PID cards for all of our season ticket holders. We had Micros point of sale system that allowed us to scan the ticket barcode and attach to all of our concession transactions, the customer identifier. You know, we were working with Ticketmaster very early on and to basically get data extracts from them that we could plug into our on-premise data warehouse that we had created. So I think one, just kind of recognizing that we needed to acquire and organize that data. So we started by building that on-premise enterprise data warehouse. We licensed from SAS a number of different software tools that we first and foremost used to kind of build that data warehouse, but then started to automate reports. You know, you hear people like always asking for quick wins. And I think automating reports was one of the biggest wins that we had, because every organization, and we still do it today, but every organization has reports that are being generated within different business units that are repetitive in nature. And if you have access to that data and you can essentially script the report programmatically, you give a lot of people time back and freedom back to do more valuable tasks. So building the data warehouse, then automating reports were kind of our quick wins. And then we really ventured into making predictions about our customers. And in 2010, we were a really good basketball team, and we knew that it was important for us to, as it still is today, to try to retain as many season ticket holders as possible. So a lot of our value case in terms of investing in analytics was, how can we help improve retention with our season ticket holders by predicting which of them are at risk of renewing their seats, some of the factors that they may be at risk of renewing them, and then use that insight to form a better service strategy and service operation. So those were kind of the key starting points that we had. From there, we started, I guess what I'm saying is, like, we started with the data and building that foundation as the foundation. So building the data warehouse and doing all of that. Then we needed a CRM system, and that came secondary to building our data warehouse, but we didn't have a pure CRM system that we could use to put the data back into in a way that was really most valuable for all of our sales and our service staff, and yep. also allowed them to effectively track their correspondence, interactions, and input data in a way that was more convenient. So I think we got a little bit lucky, but it also ended up being the right approach, which was the center of our kind of analytics universe was our warehouse. Mm-hmm. And then after that came our CRM system, where I know a lot of teams first were investing in CRM and trying to kind of use that as their data warehouse, and came to the true data warehousing after the fact. We were fortunate to, I think, have the reverse, which has worked really well for us.
I mean, there is many paths to that. I mean, for me, the main takeaway is the size of the team when it started, of only three people, because it's the very much the, oh, can you build this massive, you know, can you climb this mountain? And people think you need teams of people, and it's literally, you know, three people or 10 people can still climb Everest. It's done the same way, because, you know, when I look at the US and the data and the analytics CRM data warehouse space, I think the US sports is far away the leader in the space, you know, with what you guys are doing in Orlando and a lot of teams in the NBA and the NFL. I think that's where there's, you know, definitely leadership in the space globally, in the efforts that have been and efforts been done, where other industries, and, you know, I'll put a little bit of Australia in here, in that they're still in that early part of CRM, you know, what's our data warehouse look like? Going from mass market, hey, here's everybody, to you know, the segmentation and the analysis you can do from a data warehouse to make the right decisions, rather than just saying, oh, that's a cool new product, we need to put that product into our mix, without having the data that backs it up and says, well, that product works for your database. I think that the warehouse CRM or CRM warehouse is a bit of skill set and what you're trying to do, but you can get there either way.
Absolutely. And you're absolutely right. There are many different paths that organizations can take to just better managing their data, being smarter, being more sophisticated in their campaigns and their segments and their personalization. Because there are absolutely cases of teams that have gone at it the opposite way that we have and are ending up in a similar place. You know, our journey was just, I think, one in which the data warehouse was our starting point, and we've built on top of that to our CRM system, our marketing automation, now basically plugging all of that into our mobile app, and have moved kind of our journey and path along that direction.
Similar to the strategy piece, like the easy thing in the data and BI space is to be in firefighting mode a lot. Like, here's a problem. What's the data say? How do we tackle it? To you know, what's the longer piece? Because the firefighting stuff is good wins. It gets, you know, gets the slaps on the back and, hey, thanks guys, you fixed this, or hey, we fixed our season retention problem a little bit. How do you stay, you know, firefighting is really important because, you know, the house is on fire. You need to look after it, but also try to have that longer term vision. How do you balance that in the data space? Because you want to have those wins.
Yeah. Yeah, we constant challenge, the same kind of going back to the focus on the now compared to the focus on the future. We are just kind of, in terms of where our team is, and I think the nature of the NBA is it's more of a transactional league. We play 41 regular season games, 3 preseason games. You know, I have a game on Wednesday, December 5th, Friday, December 7th, Wednesday, the 19th. So all of those games represent deadlines and inventory that I'm trying to move and trying to put people into our building. So there is inevitably, just because of the nature of our business, a focus on the here and now, and mm-hmm. what are we doing to make sure our tickets are priced accurately. Then there's also the, well, you know, what is the ticketing product going to look like in 3 years, in yep. 5 years? How are we preparing ourselves for that? How are we working with our key partners, whether it's your ticketing provider, whether it's your mobile app provider, to move in a smarter and more sophisticated direction. So I think that, some of those answers are, we definitely are putting out fires. That's, yep. that's just like part of the sports business, model. And, but what we've done is we've been able to build these like predictive analytics tools, and whether it's our game rating model that we use to forecast ticket demand for all of our games, that's yep. informed us, like some of this isn't rocket science, but yep. some of these insights have been really foundational to like, how do we optimize our schedule so that we're playing games during periods that are going to enable us to sell more tickets? And, you know, Orlando is one of the biggest tourist destinations in the world. And there are markets like Brazil and Argentina and the UK that frequent Orlando. And so for Brazil, January is the middle of the summer. And yep. if we can play more home games in January, we sell those games really well. And tourists are less sensitive to who our opponent is. Yeah. So there's some insights that we've learned just from like building these predictive models. You know, another one would be our season ticket holder renewal model. Well, ticket utilization is really important. Ability to effectively resell their seats is really important. We've developed a solution now where our season ticket holders can give us back tickets for games that they don't want to go to and create a digital currency called Magic Money that they can spend on concessions, retail, seat upgrades. So it basically allows them to flex their investment yep. across whatever area they want while we acquire all the data and can see what they're spending it on. So those are some examples where I think like if you're really like thoughtful about it, some of the responses to your firefighting requests, like, you know, who's coming to our game yeah. this week, or how do we better price these games, can lead. You have to have some time and ability to step back. And I think, you know, do the analysis that's going to tell you, okay, like, how do we play more games in Orlando in the month of January? Like, how do we structure our schedule submission and work with the NBA to try to accommodate that? Or how do we build products with our technology partners that give our season ticket holders more flexibility? And so those are, I think, good examples of where we've tried to toe the line between the here and now yeah. and the future. But it's a constant challenge. And there are other areas where I know that it's like we've got to spend more time thinking about it. I would tell you yeah. premium seating is an area that keeps me up at night right now, because I think that we're seeing a change in the market's appetite to buy the traditional suite product yep. and these like very high price, I don't want to call them burdensome, but in some yeah. ways they are. If you're buying a suite for every event in our arena, you know, that could be 200 events with 16 tickets for each of those events. And that's not the way that the world is going. Everything's around subscription and kind of on demand and, you know, yeah, flexibility.
No. So yeah, no one wants that big no one wants that big commitment, which is, you know, leading to I think the Atlanta Hawks and the Spurs sort of opening up that large sort of, you know, bar sort of area that is in that sort of space, but you don't in a traditional suite, but you're getting the traditional suite experience, and that's where the stadium is molding to what the market demands are, and you know they're transforming parts of arenas around that sort of, I guess, concept.
Yeah, and so that's another area where we've got to, you know, we still have to go to market this year and renew our premium customers and kind of explain to them what their investment is going to provide them. But we're also trying to think about how do we better package it? You know, what does this look like in years to come? And that's where we, you know, fortunately, because the sports business community is pretty collaborative. Yep. We can call on our friends in Atlanta and San Antonio and see them at SEAT and see them at all these different industry events and hear their story of what led them to their decisions.
And so it is a little bit of hearing some of those trends, whether it is the Netflix style ticketing pass where it's, you know, all the games you can go to for a certain price and it's a reformatting what a season ticket might look like, or, you know, what the Golden State Warriors are doing, you know, being in a unique position, offering a pass that gets you into the stadium but doesn't get you a seat. Are you sort of trying your best to filter all these new and innovative ideas and then throwing it into your models to say, well, does this work for our market? And how does it fit for the Orlando market?
Yeah, we've tried, and I think we have obviously some examples of success, like our Magic Money program, and the effect that has had on helping improve our season ticket product and also our Fast Break Pass product. But even our Fast Break Pass product is one where we've done a lot of experimentation. So that is similar to what you described that the Warriors had. We launched this 5 years ago, and it was a non-seat specific ticket that you would buy at a kind of a deep discount. You didn't own a ticket. There was no ticket that you could essentially like resell, but you knew you had a pass, was what I would call it, that eventually what you would tell you where you're going to sit, but you wouldn't know that until an hour before tip.
Okay.
And we have these different like seasonal passes that we sell. So we have a fall pass. We call it our all-star pass, but it's really like January and February. And sometimes we have an end of season pass as well. But you know, it took us a couple of years to like figure out the right rhythm to that. And we've tried passes that have been like a weekday pass and a weekend pass and things that haven't worked as well. And I think one of the opportunities that exists for teams, like we've been, over the last 5 years, we struggled in terms of wins and losses, but that has caused us to try to be innovative and creative and trying new things and how we market and how we package. And I think that, you know, your challenges are entirely different when you're the Warriors. And I'm not saying that they don't have challenges, but they're just different from the challenges that are going to exist for the Orlando Magic. And, you know, looking at some of the opportunities that we've had to be creative and try new and different things has led us to learn a lot. But you have to have, and I know you've talked with Jack Elkins and kind of the innovation culture that we have, which is being open to failing. And if you are going to fail, and this is, again, kind of cliche and buzzword, but fail fast, but try to fail smart and learn from it. And I do think that, like, we've embraced that as much as we can to try to learn from what others are doing, try certain things in our market, see how it works. And if it does, then kind of build it over time.
Yeah. But it is real important to have that coming from management to say, we want you to try things and not feel fear of if it fails, there's going to be massive repercussions, because then everyone ends up playing safe. You don't try different things. You don't find the different, I guess, success stories if you don't have that, you know, innovation fail fast sort of mentality in an organization, because it can be really restrictive to all your staff, because you can say, hey, here's all the tools, you know, come back with a great idea. And it's like, it seems a bit risky and we don't do it, and can be terribly demotivating. So I'm assuming the opposite of the Magic, having that innovation focus and, you know, anything is possible and yes, we're going to try something and fail fast, must be quite liberating working for the Magic.
Yeah, it certainly can be. I think the other piece that I would layer on, and just to kind of the challenges that are faced in sports, is because for us, like the real opportunities that we have to deliver great fan experiences, touch and interact with our fans, and to, you know, honestly generate revenue are games. And we only play, even though the NBA plays like more than the NFL, obviously, it's only it's only 44 games if you include our preseason.
Yeah.
And those are kind of precious opportunities, and that sometimes lends itself to being overly conservative or risk averse. So I think that what the innovation spirit that the Magic organization has helped to, lessen the conservatism around just like, this is so precious and important. Like, we can't risk it. So being, we've got to try and we've got to learn, and just be as smart as we can and disciplined as we can about, you know, recognizing what's working and not, and then reacting with that. So it is liberating. It's also just challenging because, like, you know, we only have one renewal campaign a year.
Yeah.
And we have to do everything we can to make it as effective as possible. And the difference with a company like Disney that has theme parks that are open essentially every day of the entire year, they have just a lot larger sample to draw upon and make conclusions where, you know, if we take like five games to test, well, let's turn this concession stand into a self-service one.
Yep.
And if it doesn't work, like that's a fairly significant percentage of our games. So I think that it's important, perhaps even more in sports, to have some of the innovative spirit because of just the uniqueness of like the model and the preciousness of some of those opportunities, because you can very easily steer yourself into like being too risk averse and not learning, and kind of continually optimizing your ways.
So you've been in the sports business for a while now and in the data ticketing venue space. So what excites you about the data ticketing venue space looking forward?
I think we're seeing teams be more creative and innovative in using technology and redefining like what a ticket means. I think whether it's some of the things that we've done, whether it's the venue pass that the Warriors are doing, whether it's the flexible like investment I know that the Oakland A's are doing.
Yep.
I just think we're kind of seeing the convergence of data, technology, and new thinking occurring in ways that are creating new approaches to filling our buildings. And it's exciting. I don't know exactly what it's going to look like, but I do think for a long time, you've gone to as many of these conferences as I have.
Yep.
And we've heard death of the season ticket. And
yep.
I don't know that it's going to ever die. I think you'll always have people that are just like passionate enough fans that they'll want to come to every game or almost every game. But I think that there's so much now that's influenced by the Netflix of the world.
Yep.
And the on-demand, I want it when I want it and I don't want to pay more, that it is kind of seeping over into sports. But I also think we're seeing sports react to it. And that's exciting to me. I think that especially just working in ticketing and data and technology and kind of the convergence of all of those, seeing where we're headed, or at least glimpses into where we're headed is something that is exciting to me.
Yeah. I mean, I agree. I think all of the innovation that's happening, you know, via our mobile phone, you know, like you said, the Uber of the Airbnb of all of these, opportunities that are disrupting traditional businesses, to a certain degree, a lot of those businesses have been broken, and that's why the disruption is working. And there's a little bit of, oh, well, cool, we'll take this disruption to sports, which is still large, very, very popular and very, very engaging, and fans still want it. And so it's really just a mechanism to get there. It doesn't necessarily mean, oh, it's going to be broken. Like, going to sports events isn't what taxi industry was and is not the opportunity, but, you know, what can we learn? Like, all this innovation is happening in this space. What are the best bits that end up in sports that most likely just change what we know as a season ticket? Because it's already changed from 20 years ago, you know, when it was a paper ticket and it would get clicked, or it would, you know, or you'd have all these tickets and hand them off and the stub would get ripped. Like, that's, it's already changing now. So, you know, what our kids and our kids' kids know as a season ticket is going to be vastly different. It's just, where is technology going to play in that space? That's a bit that, you know, that's a bit that excites me. I agree with you. This, it's not going to die, because people, sports fans still love sports. They still want to go. It's just like, how are we going to get them there, and how are we going to get them to the game?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think you're absolutely right. I mean, you're right. The sports is still an incredibly great market to be in, because people love the unscripted nature of it. They're passionate about teams in ways that they aren't passionate about anything else. And having the ability to take the positive disruption that's occurred and with companies like Uber and apply it to an industry, you're right, that's not broken. It's just, you know, it is exciting.
And some of it's not technology. Like, in my part of the world in Melbourne, I like to say that, you know, they're leaders in the world in membership marketing. So, you know, it's not called season tickets here. It's called you're a member. And so it becomes an identity piece, and it's marketed as an identity piece. And I talk about, you know, the AFL membership marketing people, they're now at guilt level. If I meet someone who's a Collingwood supporter, my first question to them is, are you a member? Like, they've got the fans going out there doing the recruitment. Right. And it's just a it's just a language thing to say, oh, well, let's call them a member, which makes it feel a little more inclusive, like you're part of our club, and those kind of things. And I can't, you know, I joke that as a membership manager of an AFL team, you get them on that escalator, which you have them in the CRM. It's like, eventually you say, here's my credit card. Yeah. It's okay. Just keep it. Just like, I'm right here. I'm not going anywhere. And that's not, there's no technology involved in that. That's, you know, that's identity and marketing and making people feel like they're part of the club. And so, like, some of it's technology, and some of it's just how people feel, which is the unique part of sports for mine.
And I would add to that. I totally agree. It's not just technology, but it's delivering the fan experience, and that goes to your customer service, that goes to training, that goes to having a well-designed and well-maintained, like, physical space, whether that's your concourse, whether that's a club. And you have to, technology helps get people there and helps, you know, renew them. But you ultimately have to have talented and amazing staff that are delivering that high touch and that great experience when fans are coming to your game, because that's also the unique part of sports as well, where, you know, we want, like, customer service reps, and there are certain aspects to it that I think are not tied to technology, but that's where it's fun to work with those departments and help apply quantitative thinking and analytics, but ultimately know that, you know, they're part of the businesses is crucial to our success going forward as well.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. Just before we wrap up, I want to ask you, tell me a little bit about Sports to Change.
Oh, sure. I'd be happy to. So Sports to Change is a nonprofit organization that I started probably about 5 years ago, and started it with some close friends and colleagues. And its mission is to use sports as kind of a vehicle for positive social change. And the way that we aim to do that is by facilitating volunteer opportunities for student athletes with existing nonprofits. So in some ways we are kind of an intermediary or a matchmaker, but our model is we basically go and take the burden away from high school coaches and but convince them or at least present them with the opportunity to get their athletes and their team members involved in the community by volunteering with organizations like the Special Olympics, Habitat for Humanity, Second Harvest Food Bank, Clean the World. There's a whole handful of them that we work with. And it kind of started as a pet project of mine, and I've been really fortunate to get to work with friends and make some new friends and colleagues through this process, and use something that I am passionate about as a former college student athlete and as someone who has volunteered really closely with Special Olympics over a number of years into kind of its own nonprofit model that is really trying to just give back. And our goals are twofold. One is to just provide nonprofits with a pool of volunteers that are talented and reliable. But then the other mission is to teach and instill into youth student athletes the value of being involved in your community. And hopefully that leads to them being more community, civically and community involved over time and giving back their time and their money as they grow into future leaders.
Terrific, terrific. Well, you can check that out, Sports to Change on Twitter. I'm with Jay Riola, Senior Vice President of Orlando Magic. Going to hit you with the Sports Geek Closing Five. Thank you for taking the time. Do you remember Do you remember your first sports event you ever attended?
I do. What I will tell you is it's kind of twofold. One, it was a Denver Nuggets game at McNichols Sports Arena, which doesn't exist anymore. But as part of that, I was, we got to play before the game. It was with my YMCA youth basketball team, and we got to play on the Nuggets court before the game. So pretty memorable, but
They had the sweet rainbow jerseys back then.
That's right.
Fully retro. You're like, yeah, that's when I played. you've been to a few sports events in your time, and you would have seen the food scene evolve, especially at Magic venues over the journey of multiple stadiums and refits. Do you have a favorite food memory or a go to food item when you're at a sports event?
I'm a little bit ashamed to admit it, but I honestly am, when I'm in a sports venue, I'm one of those types who wants the standard concession fare. Yep. And I actually like just a good old fashioned hot dog, particularly if I'm going to, and I'm not a huge baseball fan, but if I'm ever like going to a baseball game, that to me just feels right.
Yep.
So that is probably what I would tell you my answer would be, as much as I, like a lot of people would claim that I like to eat healthy. If I'm going to a sporting event, if there's just something that feels right,
it's part of the fan experience, isn't it? It's embedded. What's the first app you open in the morning?
I'm going to give you two. Yeah. One is, just being honest, is probably my Outlook app. And we have a couple of reports that come in really early in the morning that I always look at just to see what sales are or some of our other key KPIs are. But the other one that I open every morning is either my Spotify or my podcast app. So I'm a very avid kind of music and podcast listener. So those are the two that I go to if I'm working out in the morning. Those are the first that I'm going to open up.
So, and this is not a self-indulgent piece. What podcast do you listen to? Because as a podcaster, it has a podcast search issue. It's really hard to find good podcasts. So when I find someone that listens to podcasts, I always ask them, what podcast do they listen to?
Sure. Well, one that I am exhausted, but I love listening to would be Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History.
Yep.
I don't know if you've had the opportunity to listen to his, but I love how he's able to take he's a great storyteller, but he's also able to take complicated situations and make or complicated stories and kind of simplify them in a way that's interesting and easily understood. So I think he's one that I would point you towards. I don't know if you've listened to the Serial podcast, which are kind of investigative journalism, but with a storytelling to it as well. Those are another one that I would listen to as well.
Yeah. So Serial, start at season one. Don't start now. Go back to the beginning is what I always tell people if they haven't listened to that. The Malcolm Gladwell one. Yeah. I really enjoyed the one about free throw shooting and really the analysis on why more NBA players are not doing underhand free throw shooting when all the stats say that they should. Even Wilt Chamberlain, I thought that was a good one. And, yeah, anytime Gladwell is on Bill Simmons' podcast, it goes for a long while, but they dive in deep really quickly on a whole bunch of really good topics. So completely agree on that front. Is there someone that you follow or listen to or that you suggest the listeners should follow and why?
I was actually going to give you, before we went on to the podcast, I was going to say that I would recommend people listen to Malcolm Gladwell's Revisionist History. I think those are all just fascinating. And you're right. Like he talks like the free throw shooting one, or he talks about soccer and kind of strong link and weak link and just explains situations and phenomenons really well. So that would be one that I would definitely recommend.
And he's written a few good books as well, you know, just to be multi-talented.
100%. Yeah. And,
lastly, what social media platform is your MVP from a, and you can answer it as yourself, Jay, or from the Magic?
Well, I'll answer for myself. Twitter,
yep.
Just because I feel like Twitter does a good job of keeping me informed in an efficient manner. And I follow sports business. I follow the NBA, you know, I follow business. There's a lot of things and it's just, I like it. I know that some are moving away from it, but Twitter for me is kind of my personal MVP.
Yep.
And then I think the Magic, what I would say, I'll kind of give you two answers, but this is our 30th anniversary season. And we have, a legend content series where, Dennis Scott, who is a former Magic player, is now with NBA TV, yep. has come back and is interviewing, just legends like from the history of the organization. So Shaquille O'Neal, Anthony Hardaway, people that were really prominent within the team's history. And that content and those videos are incredibly well done. Our content production team has done an awesome job. And those are posted on Facebook, you know, with kind of clips on Instagram. So I think those are places now where I think we're doing a great job of producing and delivering really high quality content. And I would tell you are very important for us.
Well, thank you very much, Jay. Where can people find you on the internet if they want to reach out and say, hey, I listen to the podcast?
They can find, I'll go to my MVP. They can find me on Twitter. Jay? And my handle is at Jay Riola. Yeah, JAYRIOLA.
You're in the same group as me. Someone that secures their whole name, and if there's other Jay Riolas out there, too bad, so sad. I'm the same. There's an archer in Tennessee that can't get any handle because I've secured them all. So thank you very much, Jay, for coming on the podcast. Please send Jay a tweet and tell him you've listened. Really appreciate it, and I will see you next year at SEAT Daytona.
Sounds great. Yeah, it was great talking to you as well. I appreciate it.
New workshops on audience, content, distribution, valuation, and pitch following SportsGeek's Digital to Dollars process. Go to digitaltodollars.com.
Thanks again to Jay Riola. As we said there, Jay is one of the people, like myself, who has his name as his Twitter handle, JAYRIOLA. So send him a tweet. Tell him that you listened. He did say it was his MVP, so he will respond. Quick update, as I mentioned earlier, newoplteam.com.au. We are in the process of branding and names, so we had a pretty good session on the different types of names we may roll out with the team and some branding around that. The free agency period is underway, as I've said earlier. My DMs are now open. I'm really happy to sign the guys that we've signed, and there'll be announcements later this week as I'm learning the world of player contracting as a new owner. But one thing that I was really proud about last week was the launch of the hashtag OPL Trades. as I've said previously, moving into the world of esports is a little bit like jumping in a time machine. And sort of looking at the Twitter chatter, and there's a lot of Twitter chatter around the OPL and the fans and the players and the teams. There was a lot of talk about the player signings and where people were going, but there was no hashtag. So I pretty much like I did many years ago when I started working with teams, I launched OPL Trades, talked to a few people, and then sent out a tweet. If you're talking about OPL and trades and signing periods and you want to coach or you want to play, use the hashtag OPL Trades. And I've been really, really excited and to see the adoption by the community. So I'm a proud hashtag father. Like I said, I haven't launched a hashtag in a while, but it's really good to see the adoption of just simple tactics that help aggregate the fans and get them to rally around the league. So I'm looking forward to doing more of that over the coming months. Before I knock off for this episode, don't forget, if you are a listener and you would like to connect with guests and people who also listen to the podcast around the world, you can do so in Sports Geek Nation. SportsGeekNation.com is our members area. We've got a very vibrant Slack community where you can connect with executives that work in the digital space, the technology space, stadium, and also esports. Our Ask Me Anything sessions that are happening weekly have been terrific. Recent guests include a good mate of mine, Todd Kaflish. We've got Ben at the moment talking about athlete data and how that's being visualized. If you've got a question, please go in there and ask our members there, or just be lurking. There's lots of really good answers and a lot of knowledge being shared in the different channels. So you can go to sportsgeeknation.com to sign up. Until then, thanks again to my guest, Jay Riola from the Orlando Magic. My name is Sean Callanan, and you've been listening to Sports Geek.
Join Sports Geek Nation, access to exclusive Slack and Facebook groups with regular Q&A sessions with Sean Callanan. Go to sportsgeeknation.com to join. Need help with your digital rate card? Not sure how to price your assets? Is there a disconnect between digital and commercial? That is where Sean works best, in digital divorce counselor mode. Book a time for a call with Sean to discuss the Sports Geek process. Go to sportsgeekhq.com/phone call.
Go to sportsgeekhq.com for more sports digital marketing resources.